the 99% of the Filipino masses with workers at the core.
And then, hi, this is Junix. I'll just add on that Bayan advocates for the rights and welfare of our Kababayan here and in the Philippines. Our alliance also wages campaigns that assert our right to health, housing, and education over the U.S. Marcos Jr. regime's prioritization of war and profit.
So on the national level, so Bayan Oregon is our regional alliance formation, but we are a part of Bayan USA, which does similar work, but on the national level. So really serving as a campaign center for, you know, campaigns that are being waged from Seattle to New York to Florida. And our movement as a whole, like the National Democratic Movement of the Philippines and our alliance is Bayan USA. We're an extension of Bayan Philippines. So Bayan is an alliance that also exists back in our homeland, again, serving as that alliance of progressive grassroots orgs that represents a variety of classes and sectors of people.
Yeah, which I can imagine must be a difficult conversation at times with the Bayan in the Philippines. I mean, maybe that's just my own assumption, but with the current conditions that we're talking about and that you were trying to raise awareness towards, that I can imagine that could be difficult. Is there any thoughts on that own relationship, out of curiosity, from both communities across, you know, this distance?
Yeah, I would actually say, you know, we as an extension of Bayan Philippines are in step, you know, with the fight for national liberation back home. We as, you know, Filipino, both Junix and I, you know, Filipino Americans who were born here in the States, we do really see, you know, the root problems as the same, right? When we think about all of the Filipinos here in the U.S., there's about 4 million, with another 1 million being undocumented. All of us are products of forced migration, right? There are conditions in the Philippines where the peasants and the farmers are landless, and that really, you know, displaces them and drives them to then also be jobless and struggle to find part-time and full-time work, you know, in the countryside and in the cities. And that is really, those conditions of landlessness and joblessness is what forces people abroad, whether, you know, that was, you know, my mother, or for Junix, you know, their grandmother. And so our analysis really is actually pretty in step with those in Bayan Philippines, of that us as the diaspora, it's a product of forced migration. And so we're able to really wage the same fight, actually, for Philippine national liberation, just from here in the U.S.
Yeah, no, and thank you so much for explaining, you know, the generational history there. And that kind of brings me up to the next point, which is that, you know, at the moment, of course, we're currently seeing the Marcos Jr. regime kind of laying itself out since his since his ascension to power in 2022. But for those of the listeners who might not know about the Marcos kind of family in general, is there a way maybe explaining that and about the legacy of how the U.S. has played a role in that relationship for quite some time now?
Yes. So, yeah, the Philippines overall has seen, you know, several decades of open state terror. And Marcos Jr., the current president, he's actually the son of the former dictator Marcos Sr., Ferdinand Marcos Sr., who was the president in the 70s and 80s and the president who actually declared martial law. So his own father, yeah, was the one that, you know, really sent the Philippines into a state of state terror. As well as, you know, developing a lot of policies and programs that laid the basis, you know, for the joblessness that I mentioned, right? The lack of industry in the Philippines, really sending folks abroad.
Yeah, Marcos came to power not in a democratic way. He actually knows the man who owns the vote counting machines. There was also military presence, military and police intimidation at ballots there in 2022. We even saw photos of police or AFP forces who were dressed in civilian clothes when they are required to be in uniform, so people know. So a lot of different layers of corruption and vote stealing. We also had reports of, again, peasants or people who are jobless, landless, having their votes bought.
Wow.
Yes. He did not come into power democratically as he would advertise.
Since Marcos Jr. was elected in 2022, so it's been just about 2 years, you know, since he formally went into office. We've also seen a continued legacy of violence from the former president, Rodrigo Duterte, who was the one who declared the war on drugs. Mm. But Marcos Jr. specifically, under him, you know, there have been 105 extrajudicial killings, 393 people abducted, over 44,000 victims of indiscriminate bombings in the countryside, and then as well as 3.4 million people who have been red tagged, threatened, or harassed. And that really includes a wide range of people from, you know, everyday farmers who are asserting their right to till their own land, to organizers and Filipinos who are a part of the people's resistance. So it really is anyone who you know, decides to dissent in any form, anyone who's critical of the Philippine government under Marcos Jr. and all the former presidents as well, tend to have a target put on their back by media, by the state, which makes it then consequently, you know, really easy to, you know, charge them with trumped up charges under the terror law, the anti-terror law. And things like that.
Of course. Well, I mean, I think it's fine that there's a legacy here. And of course, the Philippines is experiencing its own current regime right now. And those conditions are really specific, I think, to the region. But I find that there is a legacy here, of course, of the U.S. kind of helping, whether it's financially, militarily speaking, with other governments and their upholding of dictatorships. It's an obvious legacy that we've seen across the rest of the world, I'd argue. And I think the Philippines is definitely an example of that. And I wonder, what's the connection in the modern era in American politics? And how can we bring more awareness to this issue to representatives like Senator Merkley, and then actually get some kind of action from that, from this awareness and this organization?
Yeah, you're right. The U.S. plays a huge role as, you know, the number one imperialist power in the world. And they espouse full and uncritical support of the Philippine government. And that's demonstrated by, you know, $1 billion U.S. dollars in military and security aid to the Philippine government since 2016. And all of this, too, is, you know, kind of zooming out. All of this is happening under the context of escalating tensions between the U.S. and China, really threatening, you know, inter-imperialist war. And as Bayan, as our alliance, both, you know, locally and nationally and back home, we're particularly alarmed by the U.S. using the Philippines as a pawn to intensify their military pivot to the Asia-Pacific region. And most recently, too, a pair of bipartisan senators introduced what's called the Philippine Enhanced Resiliency Act, or PERA, which would authorize $2.5 billion in military assistance from 2025 to 2029. Wow. And the PERA claims to modernize the defense capabilities of the Philippines. But we know that this money, our U.S. tax dollars here, will continue to fund, you know, the Philippine state's war crimes and counterinsurgency tactics used against the People's Army and everyday Filipinos who are fighting, you know, for self-determination and national sovereignty. And then even most recently, at the end of last month, on July 30th, U.S. Secretary of State Blinken and U.S. Secretary of Defense Austin held a what's called the 2+2 ministerial meeting in Manila with the Secretary of Foreign Affairs Manolo and Secretary of National Defense Teodoro, announcing an additional $500 million of foreign military financing to the Philippines. So that's on top of the PERA Act.
Yeah.
And so Bayan Oregon, alongside other organizations like Malaya Portland and the International Coalition for Human Rights in the Philippines, ICHIRP, as well as other allies, we, you know, are calling on our democratically elected Senator Jeff Merkley to listen to his constituents and immediately introduce the Philippine Human Rights Act and oppose the PERA. So the Philippine Human Rights Act, or the PHRA, that is a bill that would suspend financial support and security assistance to the Philippines until the government of the Philippines has made reforms to end, you know, the human rights violations and the war crimes that I had mentioned. And so that's kind of the global, like, context of what's going on, the Philippines really being used as a pawn in the war with China, similar to how Ukraine is being used in, you know, the conflict with Russia.
So for context, we have been engaging Senator Merkley in good faith since 2017. We've been asking him to introduce the PHRA into the U.S. Senate. We've done this through peaceful rallies, petitions, lobbying, legislative visits, as well as town halls with the senator and his staffers. So it's been 7 years that we have been approaching Merkley and his staff with this. And then on August 2nd, over 70 activists from both Filipino and allied organizations shut down Senator Merkley's town hall in Clackamas after two organizers asked how much longer we have to wait for Senator Merkley to stand up for human rights in the Philippines and to prioritize U.S. tax dollars for schools or healthcare or other social services that we need here in Oregon. And Senator Merkley stated he would not introduce the PHRA because he was, quote, listening to experts in the State Department that say it is necessary to keep funding the Philippines. But by continuing to support military aid in the Philippines, Merkley is using the Philippines as a proxy for the U.S. to wage war against China, just as it has done in Ukraine against Russia. So that was August 2nd. And then on August 12th, Bayan, Malaya, and iChirp returned to Senator Merkley's town halls in Washington County and Multnomah County, again asking him how many people must be kidnapped, tortured, or killed before he will take action to introduce the Philippine Human Rights Act. And at the Multnomah County Town Hall, Senator Merkley said that after August 2nd, his team reached out to human rights groups in the Philippines to investigate the human rights crisis and that he's making inquiries to the State Department. But our organizations, we're not pacified by his delay tactics. We are his constituents that have tirelessly engaged the senator and his staff on the conditions in the Philippines for 7 years now. So the senator knows who we are and how to contact us, yet he didn't reach out to any of our organizations. And we had to return to his August 12th town hall to get follow-up and answers. So it was over 30 activists that protested Merkley's delay tactics. And again, we shut down the Multnomah town hall. Like I said, we've tried to work with Merkley for 7 years. And at this point, we are demanding that he actually take action to introduce the Philippine Human Rights Act to the U.S. Senate and to oppose more military aid to the Philippines in the form of that Philippines Enhanced Resiliency Act. So from our analysis, this is really the least that Merkley can do to support our people, and we're going to continue showing up until he takes action.
And what are your kind of messages? What's your message for the public in terms of what they can do?
So first I'll share, folks can learn more about the Philippine Human Rights Act, you know, the history of it, what's going on currently with the PHRA at humanrightsph.org. That's a really informative site to just kind of see, yeah, the history of, you know, this fight for the PHRA over multiple years and in multiple regions too. You know, we're not the only region that is lobbying, you know, their representatives to take this up and introduce it. As well, too, there's actually, we have an event coming up on August 21st. Folks can join us for closing night of the Golden Years exhibit put on by Bayan Oregon and Malaya Portland. Closing night is on August 21st, 5:30 to 7 p.m. at Propulsion Zone downtown. And this event is really an opportunity to learn more about and see the documentation of the martial law era under Marcos Sr., Marcos Jr.'s dad, in the 1970s and 80s. And so we've had the opportunity over the past few weeks to have this really informative, educational, agitating photo exhibit where folks can really see, you know, what were the true conditions of martial law. And then lastly, too, I think, you know, our final call as Bayan is really to join an organization, you know, both for, you know, the conditions here in Oregon. So many Oregonians lack healthcare and struggle to find housing or adequate social services. And so we really see our fights as connected. And so we really encourage listeners to, you know, join one of the many Filipino or solidarity organizations, you know, who are taking action in our communities to fight for a better world. And so if folks have interest in any of our Filipino organizations or communities, or even, you know, we're connected to a lot of, you know, solidarity organizations and other activists in the Portland community, folks can reach out to us at buyinoregon@gmail.com if they want to get connected and plugged in.
That was KBOO's Zachary Jones-Naray speaking with Carolyn and Junix, two organizers from Bayan, Oregon, an alliance of organizations involved in the Filipino people's struggle for national liberation and democracy. Wednesday, August 21st, is the closing night of the exhibit Golden Years, Weighing Philippine Martial Law, that's at Propulsion Zone in Portland. The event is from 5:30 to 7. More information about Bayan, Oregon can be found on their Instagram at BAYAN Oregon. This is KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. We've got more in a moment. You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up on August 25th, the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project will be hosting their annual benefit in Portland. The group has been around since 1991, working to protect and restore ecosystems in the Blue Mountains and Eastern Oregon Cascades. To learn more, I spoke with Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project co-director Paula Hood. What is Blue Mountain Biodiversity Project?
So Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project is a small grassroots nonprofit, and we work to protect and restore the natural ecosystems of the Blue Mountains and Eastern Oregon Cascades. And field surveying is the heart of the work that we do at Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project. And we use information that we collect on the ground to inform our public comments and objections and pressure the agency to stop or modify logging. And our field surveys also inform our litigation work. We focus on federally managed lands in our work, federally managed public lands, and we field survey proposed timber sales on national forests in eastern Oregon and in southeastern Washington.
What does a field survey look like for you guys?
So we camp in the woods with volunteers for weeks on end. We actually go into these proposed timber sales to camp, and some of the sales are, well, many of the sales, particularly these days, are ever increasing in pace and scale of logging, and so many are quite large and range from anywhere from a few thousand acres to 20,000 acres or more. That's not uncommon at all. And so we drive into these timber sales and camp with volunteers, and they have opportunities to be with us out in the woods for weeks on end. We train them in things like map and compass skills, slope, measuring slope, measuring diameter at breast height for trees, identifying old growth characteristics and mature forest characteristics, and things of that nature. So we teach them how to conduct field surveys on the ground, and training new volunteers typically takes 2 to 3 days. And we ask that new volunteers come out for at least a week with us so that, because training does take a couple of days, and so that they can actually get some field surveying under their belt. And we car camp, we have breakfast together in the mornings, and then we go fan out throughout the timber sale, and we field survey the proposed timber sale units within that timber sale. And then we usually meet up for lunch, do the same in the afternoon, meet up for dinner, clean up, and do it all over again the next day.
What sorts of things are you focusing on now?
A lot of people don't even realize that there are so many forests, including lush forests in eastern Oregon, relatively lush forests. I know that the state is, you know, the east side is drier than the west side, clearly. But many people are surprised to learn that eastern Oregon includes approximately half of all the forests in the state, and that those forests are home to an incredible diversity of species, such as wolverine, lynx, wolves, marten, moose, bull trout, and many more. And so the region encompasses key connectivity corridors of regional importance, and those corridors connect between the Eastern Cascades and the Rockies. And they're crucial for supporting biodiversity, wildlife, and fish habitats. And that's true both within the region and for connectivity between the larger regions. And so right now, you know, I really can't emphasize how precious and special the forests in this region are. And one of the things that we're focusing on coming up that I would love to talk to you about are the forest plan revisions for the Blue Mountains. So it's important to know that folks who are listening know that there are some really big decisions and potentially big changes coming to some of the national forests in the region. And the Forest Service has just recently begun their formal process for revising forest plans for the Malheur, Umatilla, and Wallowa-Whitman National Forests. And that will affect approximately 5 million acres in eastern Oregon and southeastern Washington. And so forest plans guide virtually every aspect of management on national forests. The importance of robust public participation and advocacy for trying to get strong ecological protections really can't be overstated. We need public participation. We absolutely need your help. Forest plans include rules and guidance on a broad range of issues such as logging, livestock grazing, climate change, connectivity, wildlife, wilderness, and more. And these agency forest plans also determine whether the Forest Service is tasked with following clear, stringent, and enforceable standards in order to protect forest and stream ecosystems, or if they instead use voluntary guidelines that provide the agency much more discretion and less public accountability on how actions such as timber sales are conducted on the ground. And so we really feel this is a all hands on deck type situation, and it is imperative that the public be engaged. And so, you know, as I mentioned, they're really just starting this process. And so we hope people sign up for action alerts and stay tuned and really engage in the public comment process and in, you know, participation with us. And, you know, we're concerned because the Forest Service, we feel, has already shown their intent to roll back or severely weaken protections for wildlife in their habitats, as well as for streams, clean water, and fish, because they've repeatedly tried to roll back or weaken protections for mature and old forests and for fish and wildlife habitats. That's one of our main areas of focus right now.
I'm curious to learn more about sort of the history of forest plans in this region. What have previous iterations of it outlined? How often does the public get a chance like this to reshape how these forests are managed?
So not very often. So most of the forest plans that are in place in the area were, there was kind of a two-stage process decades ago. So most of them were put in place as individual forest plans in the 1980s. And so they're severely outdated. After the 1980s, there was a regional amendment that was part of putting in place broader protections, and that took place in the 1990s. And so that was part of what were called the East Side Screens and Packfish and Fish, and that provided a number of different sorts of very clear and quantitative protections. Since the 1990s, the Forest Service has been working to find loopholes and roll back parts of those protections. But that was really, you know, it. And then in, several years ago, there's been an ongoing process for almost a decade to try to revise the forest plans on the Malheur, Umatilla, and Wallowa-Whitman as sort of this Blue Mountains forest plan revision process. And a number of years ago, they published a draft, and then ultimately they withdrew their forest plan, and this is them sort of starting again in that process.
What are some of the specific changes that Blue Mountain Biodiversity Project is hoping to see or is pushing for in this forest plan revision process?
We would love to see even more holistic protections that are more widespread and more comprehensive for important habitats such as mature and old forests and streams and wildlife habitats, for example. It's not limited to that. We also there's it's a pretty big list, but I think that's a good summary start of the kinds of things we would like to see. What we're concerned is going to happen is, you know, similar to the last time that they had a forest plan revision process, or based on some of their recent rollbacks, we're concerned that the logging will actually end up increasing in mature and old forest areas, and as well as logging of mature trees. They're supposed to be following guidelines that look like, well, actually standards for streams and water quality that are detailed and based on the biological needs of fish and on, sensitive habitats. And we're concerned that a lot of those are going to become much more voluntary and discretionary and less quantitative and clear. One other thing that I should mention is that the Biden administration released executive orders ostensibly to try to do better at protecting mature and old forests across the nation. And those might also get added to national or amended, national forest plans might be amended with those changes at some point. That's kind of a bit separate from what we're focusing on right now, though we are also engaged in that process and also keeping our public up to date during comment periods and things like that for that process. But, some of the language in the Biden's executive orders is quite strong and sounds very good on its face, but we're also concerned that the Forest Service is taking that language and using it as sort of greenwashing speak to further what they call restoration and is actually often on the ground logging. And unfortunately, one of the things that we find in our field surveys is all too often a really big discrepancy between what the agency is calling restoration and what we're finding in post-logging projects. Not every post-logging project is like that, but many are, unfortunately. We find, old and mature trees that have been chopped down. We find virtual clear cuts. We find really heavy logging and things that really don't look like thinning in what the agency has described as thinning.
You talked a little bit about the process, but I want to address that more fully. What is the timeline for this new forest plan?
That is a good question. So, it's actually changed, and so I haven't recently checked on exactly how it's changed, but I believe that they recently put out an assessment phase, and that did have a public comment opportunity, and then they'll be going forward with scoping, I believe, later this year or possibly early next spring, and then it's unclear after that. It's likely to take 2 to 3 years to complete the process. I believe they're trying to do it more quickly, but I think, the reality is it's likely to take 2 to 3 years.
Well, to pivot slightly, I understand Blue Mountain Biodiversity Project has an upcoming event. Can you tell me about that?
Absolutely. We really want people to come out and join us, and I think it's going to be an incredibly fun event. We're having our annual benefit on the 25th from 4 to 7 p.m. at Green Anchors in Portland, Oregon. And the event will be outdoors under a large covered canopy. We're also going to have fans going. This year we're extremely excited and honored to feature flamenco music and dance performances by Espacio Flamenco, a local flamenco troupe. And we'll also have a silent auction, food, and information and a short presentation about our work. And we've received wonderful donations for our auction. So auction items include things such as a stay at Left Coast Lodge in Sisters, Oregon, a half-day tour with Wanderlust Tours in Bend, Oregon, artwork from Just Beads Art Collective and other talented local artists, gift baskets from local businesses, and lots more. Attendance for the event is a $20 suggested donation, and no one is turned away for lack of funds. And the address for the benefit is at Green Anchors, and that's at 8940 North Bradford Street, Portland, Oregon. And you can visit our website for more details about the event, and that's at BlueMountainsBiodiversityProject.org.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
We really hope that you come out and join us together with friends and supporters. We've helped to protect forests on public lands in Eastern Oregon for over 3 decades, and we are excited to see you this coming Sunday, the 25th, to help continue that work.
Well, thank you, Paula. We appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you so much.
That was Paula Hood from the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project speaking with me about her organization's work, the Blue Mountain Forest Plan Revision Process, and their upcoming benefit. It will be held Saturday, August 25th at Green Anchors in Portland, Oregon, starting at 4:30. More information is on their website at bluemountainsbiodiversityproject.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings. Thanks for listening.
Hey, what's up, everyone? It's Greg McVicar, creator of Undercurrents, and this is KBOO 90.7 Portland.